From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, NPR's Scott Simon. He's father of an adopted child and author of a soon-to-come book about adoption. Plus, Carol Carson. At age 60, she lost 62 pounds and inspired hundreds of others in Nevada County to lose weight too. Now she's an author and coach of a national online weight loss program. And the life and work of Cruz Reynoso, civil rights lawyer and former California Supreme Court justice. But first, what does it mean to be an ethical judge? How can judges keep their independence and stay accountable? These are the key questions to be raised and answered at an international legal conference this week in Sacramento. The conference organizer joins us. He's Paul Payton, law professor and director of the Ethics Across the Professions Initiative at the University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. Paul, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Great to be with you again.
What are the main pressures on judges that might make it hard for them to be ethical or at least to be perceived as ethical?
I think those are actually two very different and very important questions, because judges are bound by codes of conduct that say they're supposed to be independent, they're supposed to be impartial. They have a sense of their own bias. They have a sense where their own perception might be brought into question. There was a newspaper story this morning, for example, in the Michael Jackson trial, where it was moved to another judge's courtroom. The prosecutor was somebody for whom the judge had written a letter supporting his appointment to the bench. And so the judge declared this, said everybody can make submissions on it. Can I continue to hear this case? So in that respect, at least, the judge is very cautious about what he's doing. But the public perception of where judges go has been tested quite directly in a number of cases in the last year and continues to be tested as long as you've got elections, financing, various controversial decisions.
You wrote about this general issue in an opinion piece in the Sacramento Bee at the weekend, and you talked about questions that have been raised about the integrity of a U.S. district judge in the case of whether to overturn Proposition 8. Why was his judgment called into question?
It was a story that broke in the Washington Post early in February about Judge Yvonne Walker, who was hearing submissions on whether or not to overturn Proposition 8, which, as you know, is the case about same-sex marriage. And the story itself came out and identified Walker as gay. And so in that respect, at least, there was a firestorm of commentary afterwards as to whether or not the judge should have recused himself, as to whether or not he would have been biased. In my view, and in the view of a lot of commentators, that was completely irrelevant. But the fact that it became an issue and the questions were raised about his integrity struck me as important to identify in terms of taking a look at, you know, things like implicit bias. Would it be more important, for example, that he was actually appointed by a Republican, as or whether or not he was, you know, he was identified as gay?
Well, there's a whole spectrum of issues which might or might not be cause for a judge not hearing a case. Obviously, there are some that are no-brainers, but this is big middle ground, I guess. How do judges navigate the middle ground?
Well, again, they look for some guidance from codes of conduct. There's a very elaborate model code of judicial conduct put out by the American Bar Association in February 2007. And we've actually got the chair of the committee that drafted that code coming to the conference to speak on Saturday, and a comparison being made between domestic and international codes by a professor from the University of Akron. And we're going to get into a long discussion about, you know, how effective these codes are. There's all sorts of guidance. Can you accept gifts? Can you serve on community organizations? Can you continue to serve on a church board, for example, once you're appointed to the bench? We're pretty good at the explicit bias or the concerns about explicit bias. Campaign financing, for example, for the judges who are elected. You know, can you accept donations from lawyers who are going to appear in front of you? But in terms of dealing with implicit bias, that's a tougher question.
My guest is Paul Payton of Pacific McGeorge. He's organizing a two-day conference this week on judicial ethics and accountability. You mentioned whether or not judges should be members of community organizations. What kind of guidance is there in California in that respect? Because clearly there are organizations that are likely to be involved in legal matters and organizations that probably aren't.
The codes that are applicable to judges who are appointed here or serving in California are fairly straightforward in terms of the ability of a judge to continue as part of a community organization. And largely, and what I understand to be, you know, local practice in that respect, is that most judges will step away. It's not as though they have to be complete hermits and isolate themselves from everything that they were involved in, but in terms of taking leadership roles or being members of organizations, they have to choose and navigate carefully. Political organizations, on the other hand, are very, very difficult. And again, the perception problems are important. There's a recommendation from a California commission Commission for Impartial Courts about judges even accepting endorsements from political organizations when they're running for office. That's really controversial and has yet to be resolved.
And you also mentioned campaign financing. Clearly, when a lawyer might be bringing cases before a judge, then that could be a possible problem there if that lawyer gives money to the judge's campaign. But what about beyond that? I mean, a judge in Sacramento might often hear cases involving the state government. So what about state workers, state employees, and so on?
Well, I think there again becomes a bit of a question of this middle ground that you've identified. You know, how far away does the judge have to be from both either knowledge of the donation or does it matter the size of the donation? There was a case out of the U.S. Supreme Court last year that I talk about in the opinion piece called Caperton, and we'll have a panel discussion about the Caperton decision that was a 5-4 split. It was a situation where you had a donation from a CEO of a company to the tune of $3 million to an appellate court judge in West Virginia. When a case was actually being heard by that judge, the judge refused to recuse himself from hearing the case, and the decision went all the way up to the Supreme Court. A lot of people said that should have been a 9-0 decision, that it was a no-brainer, but obviously the Supreme Court struggled with it. So in terms of accepting donations, you know, from state workers, from others, in terms of election campaigns, you're going to have perception problems about pay-to-play. And one of the things that people are struggling with right now is it a question of degree? You know, if you get a bunch of $10 donations from individual state workers, for example, or does it have to be a large, you know, a large donation? The Supreme Court didn't give a whole lot of guidance, and the California Commission actually has 7 of the 71 recommendations out of its report struggling with that issue.
What about the Supreme Court nomination process last year of Sonia Sotomayor? A lot of attention was placed on her famous wise Latina quote. Was that an ethical issue? Did she raise an ethical issue when she suggested, intentionally or not, that a wise Latina might reach a better conclusion, at least on occasions, than a white male?
That 2001 speech, when she gave it at Berkeley, became the lightning rod for partisan discussion of her nomination as to whether or not she could actually be biased or not biased. And I think it actually points to the question of implicit bias. But if you take a look at the rest of the speech, and I'm not saying this from any partisan perspective, you take a look at the rest of the speech, she's wondering out loud whether judges can be impartial. That's a lot of what we're going to be spending time on at the conference. You know, can judges overcome not only this question of explicit bias, but implicit bias? And are we looking to judges to be sort of representative of the community? Are they, you know, supposed to be our nominees if we're from a particular regional or ethnic or gendered group? Or do they leave all of that identity behind when they come on the bench? I think it's a debate worth having. And if we've got a nomination likely again to come this year, I think we'll see it happen again.
And finally, Paul, there's an international component to the conference on judicial ethics that you're organizing. You have speakers from Canada, Ireland, and Rwanda. Why are there international issues of interest to Northern California lawyers?
Well, I think the question of globalization in the law is something that's both really important at McGeorge generally and at the University of the Pacific, but also to the profession. You've actually got the American Bar Association striking an Ethics 2020 commission with two tasks or two areas of focus. One is technology, the other is globalization. So in taking a look at what judges are doing internationally, I think we in California can learn a lot from that, particularly on issues of bias. One of the judges, John Hedigan, who's from the High Court in Ireland, is actually giving our luncheon address on Friday talking about 47 traditions, one court in the European Court of Human Rights. Are you supposed to be voting for your country when it's represented? Or again, do you leave that national bias behind? So some of the local issues that we're talking about implicit and explicit bias, are writ large in international tribunals. And as lawyers get engaged with the world increasingly, especially from a state that's, you know, anchored in the Pacific, I think it's important to look at those issues.
And that national versus international issue you raised there, is there explicit guidance to the judges? Do they vote their country or do they vote internationally with a broad international perspective?
Well, again, it's a case where the judges are guided by different rules of the different tribunals, and we'll get into some of those discussions. And Judge Hedigan was actually involved in writing some of those rules for the European Court. Judge Fausto Pokar from the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, who's speaking on Saturday, has also been involved in those issues. Whether or not there's explicit guidance, it's almost my analogy is to figure skating. Do you vote the country or do you actually vote based on what you see as the technical performance in front of you? And I think that analogy actually works in certain cases because judges are often appointed by their countries or nominated by their countries with the country bias explicitly in mind.
Paul Payton, law professor and director of the Ethics Across the Professions Initiative at University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. He's organizing a two-day conference this week, Friday and Saturday, called Judicial Ethics and Accountability at Home and Abroad. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Terrific to be here, Jeffrey. Thanks very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. We'll stay with the legal theme. Coming up, Cruz Reynoso, the civil rights lawyer and former California Supreme Court Justice. There's a new film about him. We'll be right back. It's Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Find our podcast at capradio.org/insight. One of California's best-known lawyers and judges is honored tonight in Sacramento with a new film about his life and work. Cruz Reynoso was born in Orange County in 1931 and spent part of his childhood in farm work. Reynoso's career highlights include directing California Rural Legal Assistance and serving on the state Supreme Court, although he and two other justices lost their seats after a heated recall campaign. Reynoso joined us on Insight in January 2009 while serving on then-President-elect Obama's transition team. Specifically, he was part of a team reviewing justice and civil rights issues. I asked Cruz Reynoso if Obama or his staff gave guidelines on what they were looking for.
One of the few specific matters that we were given is actually to do a review of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. So there we actually talked to the people who were there, talked to commissioners, got impressions from many folk. I myself am a former commissioner of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, so I think I knew something about that agency. So that was very specific in terms of that agency. Beyond that, however, there have been meetings with various groups that have that have interests in several civil rights areas, whether it's employment, whether it's education. I haven't been asked personally to then provide a memo on those issues.
The review that you're doing here, how exactly do you do it? I mean, what does this involve?
It involves. There are something like 15 persons who've been appointed to the Justice and Civil Rights group, and that group has had meetings together. I should tell you that I could not attend the first such meeting in Washington, so I attended by phone. And folk went around the table and introduced themselves. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, these folk would never have gotten together with the old administration. This is really exciting. These are folk that really have been in the field of justice and civil rights for years and years. So I was very excited about that. And then I've been back to Washington twice now to have a series of meetings, and the idea really is, I guess, consistent with the president's notion of wanting to really start quickly, is to have a lot of possibilities. In fact, they've asked us to very often put down our memos in terms of options. These are the policy options that will be presented here, whether we agree with them or not, and then make our own recommendations, of course.
What would you hope to see in the Obama administration in terms of civil rights?
Well, in terms of civil rights, I would hope that we would pick up with the ideals that are really found in the legislation and really in the Bill of Rights in terms of the rights that we have as citizens to all be treated equally. Sad to say, many people believe that the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King cured all those matters. Sad to say, we still have many issues dealing with civil rights, among them education, employment, housing. And so there's a great deal to be done. And beyond that, too, the issues of voting, the issues we just talked about, in many ways, the civil rights of not being searched unless there's a good reason. All of those need to be at a high priority, I think, in terms of this administration.
Cruz Reynoso is a law professor emeritus at UC Davis, a former justice of the California Supreme Court, which brings me to another issue, legal issue, in California of the day, and that is Proposition 8. The Gay Marriage Initiative, the constitutional amendment that banned gay marriage in California last November. The California Supreme Court is going to hear three cases challenging Proposition 8. They're also going to have to rule on the status of the same-sex marriages that happened in the last few months. And related to that, Attorney General Jerry Brown says that at first he said as Attorney General he would enforce Proposition 8, but he now says that Proposition 8 actually itself violated the Constitution because people have a right to liberty. Where do you stand on Proposition 8?
Well, I went over the opinion very carefully. In the opinion, the Supreme Court analogized what had been happening to other earlier rulings where rights have been protected that actually had not been protected by the U.S. Constitution but protected by the California Constitution, including, for example, the California Supreme Court was the first court in the country to rule that that gender was a matter of protection by the Constitution. You couldn't discriminate against women or men, for that matter. And they defined those who were the subject of the litigation as a discrete minority, which has always had the highest protection constitutionally, both by the U.S. Constitution and the California Constitution. Though I want to stress, we're dealing only with the California Constitution in this issue. So it has seemed to me that it would be very difficult for the four justices who ruled in favor of same-sex marriage to now go against their own writings. Now, I should tell you, there's a very distinguished constitutional law professor at Davis, where I teach, who feels that it may not be that difficult for them to get around it. But my own reading is that it will be very difficult for them to get around it. So my own prediction is that they will rule that Prop 8 was, in fact, unconstitutional and will set it aside. There are actually two different issues here. One is that if there's going to be a drastic change to the Constitution, there's another way of doing that. It has to go to the legislature and then to the people. And the second issue, of course, is whether or not there's a fundamental right as described by the statements by Jerry Brown. And the court, under either theory, could rule that Prop 8 actually was unconstitutional. So I should tell you that I was wrong in my prior prediction, so I may be wrong this time, but my feeling is that it'll be very difficult for them to get around their own language, their own reasoning.
What do you think about Attorney General Jerry Brown's shifted position here? As I said, at first he said, I'm the Attorney General of the state of California, so therefore we're going to enforce Prop 8. But then he said, upon further consideration, I need to argue against Prop 8 because it violates the Constitution.
Well, it has always been true that the Constitution is superior to the statutes, or even to suggested change if it's not done properly. So it struck me that he may in fact be correct in his second opinion. Very often, judges and lawyers on second look at an issue will decide differently.
Speaking of Jerry Brown, when he was governor, he named you to the California Supreme Court.
That's correct.
And at that time, the Chief Justice was Rose Byrd, who was also named by then-Governor Jerry Brown. Then Jerry Brown, there was a lot of controversy about him. The voters in the end voted Rose Byrd and you and another justice off the court. What's your memory of that period?
Oh, well, it was a period that was very challenging to the court because, in my view, practically all of the attacks on the court didn't have a proper foundation. People would say the court loves criminals more than victims, or the critics would say the court is letting prisoners out on the street. In fact, when the court overturned a death penalty, for example, the person had already been convicted of murder. So the person never went out of the street. They were already in prison for life, so none of those folk were ever out in the street. So it was, in my view, an unprincipled attack on the court. And Unfortunately, the campaign against the Chief Justice apparently was going so well that those who were against the Chief Justice and the court decided later in the campaign, well, we'll try to take over the court by adding a couple of justices to it. So I viewed it strictly as a political campaign. I must say that even a gentleman that I greatly admire said to me, "Gee, Cruz, you're such a fine justice. Are you sure that the court can't sentence a few more people to death, you know, not sentence them, but affirm them?" And I was too respectful of him to remind him that as a judge, it was my duty to judge each case individually and do what I thought justice required. Judges can't be political, but politicians can be political. And I think that's really what happened.
Were you and Rose Byrd and the other justice, did you just unfortunately get caught up in controversy around Jerry Brown?
Well, I don't know whether it was about Jerry Brown. The big public controversy at that time was actually the death penalty. I say the public controversy because, as I understand it, most of the money came from economic interests, particularly insurance companies, that really had not liked the rulings of the Supreme Court since Justice Traynor going back 20, 30 years, because the Supreme Court had always been very supportive and protective of the legislation that protected the working people, protected those who had insurance policies, et cetera. That is, it had been a very sensitive court. And I think that some of those business interests didn't like that, and so they put a lot of money into it. I guess in other states, they've learned about the possibility of having judicial victories because now we have the phenomenon we've had in other states of business interests putting in literally millions of dollars in supporting candidates for the Supreme Court of their states. So I think we'll have to worry about, fortunately, that hasn't happened in California, but if it does happen, we'll have to worry about whether or not it's a good system where money can be that important in deciding who judges are.
And finally, Cruz Reynoso, before you became a lawyer, then a judge and a justice and a law professor, you were born in California of a farmworking family. Do you
That's
think
correct.
Back to those days?
Can I think back to those
Do
days?
Do you think back to those
oh,
days?
Oh, of course, all the time. That's my background. Sure.
How did it form you?
My folks came from Mexico. They worked hard. I was born in Orange County at a time when my first job was picking oranges. There were actually orange groves in Orange County in those days. I worked then as a pin setter before there were machines that picked up the pins in bowling alleys. We went to the Central Valley to pick fruit. I always tell people that we picked plums, not prunes. You know, Californians are called prune pickers, but we actually pick plums, then
yes.
They become prunes. And sure, I think that I grew up understanding many values. I grew up during the Depression, and hobos would come and knock on our door and ask for food. And my mom would put out this great meal for them, tortillas, carnitas, the whole kit and caboodle. And we would complain to our mother that she fed the hobos better than she fed us. And she wouldn't deny that. But she would say, you know, we're lucky that your dad is working during the Depression, and we have a duty since we have clothing on our back, food on the table, to help others. And I've always remembered that. I remember, too, when we were picking plums, there was a murmur in the grove. And I was just a kid. I didn't quite know what was happening. Then all of a sudden, everybody stopped picking. There was a sit-down strike. And then I was always curious, so I sort of wiggled my way to a group of men. And after a while, the field foreman came down this embankment with billows of sand behind his pickup truck. And he parked by that group of men. And the first question he asked was, "All right, who started this? Not what's the problem, but who started this?" And so apparently they explained to him, apparently we were being paid less per box than other workers. But of course, the plums had to be picked, so very soon they reached an accommodation. And I've always been impressed by the power that a group of people working together have, far more than individuals working individually. So I've always been impressed by that.
And at what point in all those years did it occur to you to become a lawyer?
Not until late high school or early college. I was actually going to be an artist. I worked for a commercial artist in high school and college, and that was going to be what I was going to do. But I was always interested in the social life of... I grew up in a barrio. I attended a segregated school. You know, they had what they called Mexican schools in those days. I saw a lot of injustices. And so I thought, so as I grew up, I thought that as a lawyer, I'd be able to do more about those issues than as an artist. So I decided to become a lawyer.
Do you still paint or draw or whatever in your spare time?
I sketch. Yeah. I'm afraid that I haven't continued to develop my painting and sketching skills. And I noticed that I sketch about the same way I did some years ago, whereas most artists that keep at it full time, their styles change. My style has remained about the same. Actually, my wife was a little bit concerned because when arguments started getting sort of slow at the Supreme Court, I draw some of the lawyers presenting the arguments. I figured, look, people are always drawing judges. Why can't judges draw the people who are arguing?
And did your parents live to see you on the Court of Appeal in the Supreme Court?
They did, at least to the Court of Appeal, and my dad was able to attend my swearing in to the Supreme Court. And it was quite a difference, having been raised in a barrio and having attended segregated schools and having been a farm worker to end up being on the Supreme Court of California and being able to do all the things that I've been able to do. Much of it based on the fact that we at least had a good public education in California, and I pine for those days, and I think we need to get back to those days.
Well, Cruz Reynoso, law professor at UC Davis, member of President-elect Obama's Justice and Civil Rights Agency Review, former Justice of the California Supreme Court. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you very, very much. A pleasure to be with you and a pleasure to have this station and this community.
Cruz Reynoso on Insight early last year. The film, Cruz Reynoso, Sowing the Seeds of Justice, is tonight at 6:30 at Sacramento's Crest Theater. You're listening to Insight. Coming up, NPR's Scott Simon. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow, a Holocaust survivor who was a cast member of an opera first performed in a Nazi concentration camp. She's in town for a performance of the same opera. Plus, Jerry Camillus, the man behind the plan to build an arena in downtown Sacramento. One of NPR's most popular hosts and most respected journalists is also an author. Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday, has written 4 books, 2 about baseball and 2 novels. His 5th book, about adoption, comes out this year. Scott Simon is also coming to Sacramento soon to speak at California Lectures. He's on the phone. Scott Simon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, you and your wife adopted a baby girl a few years ago. Did that inspire your book about adoption?
It's the whole reason for it. We actually have 2 daughters who are adopted from China, and this is a terrible generalization, but we have a social worker who refers to those of us who have adopted children from overseas as perhaps the most overly literate people on earth, because we're always writing books about it. And a lot of them are privately published, and some people were very, very kind enough to send me their privately published books and their journals. And we enjoyed reading them and learned something from each and every one of them. And it was when my publisher, Random House, mentioned the possibility of doing a book about adoption. The important thing to us would be that it not just be based on our experience, but that I talk to other people who had done it, people who adopted overseas, people who adopted domestically. Because I understand my wife and I are still in the rapturous stage of parenthood, much less adoption. Our little girls are, one is almost 7, the other one is 3.5. And of course, noting that they are perfect in every way, this is the rapture stage of parenthood, and I understand that a lot of people who have grown up with adoption have more significant experiences to impart, and we learn something new every day. So I felt very uncomfortable about basing it just on our experience, but I wanted to base it on also the experiences of others, although certainly the predominant part of the book is based on our own rapturous experience.
Why did you and your wife choose to adopt from overseas?
You know, we took a look at one program after another. For one thing, I think international adoption just fit us. in terms of who we are. My wife is from France. I'm from a multi-ethnic family. As a reporter, I've ranged widely around the world. My wife, for that matter, has certainly lived widely around the world. And there was something about it that just seemed to suit us. It's also a fact of life that for one reason or another, the wait for domestic adoption can be very, very long. And there are things where people can enter into private contractual adoptions and relationships with lawyers and that sort of thing. And that for a lot of different reasons. I don't criticize people who do it, but for a lot of different reasons, and that can be very quick. But for a lot of different reasons, that just did not appeal to us. And then some adoption programs we were ruled out for one reason or another, because of age, my age, not my wife's. My wife is incredibly young still, or other considerations. And we also didn't want to wait too long. We were reconciled to waiting some period of time, but not some of the longer waiting periods that you hear about. So we wound up going to China.
Have you and your wife talked with your children about adoption?
Well, they have. Yes. Although there was, when you adopt from overseas and you are not yourself Chinese, there is never a moment of truth.
Sure.
When you have to say, "Sweetheart, I have something to tell you." You're adopted. They have both grown up knowing it and are very comfortable with it, which is, not to say there aren't certain sensitivities that can't be rubbed. Each of our little girls has gone through a delightful period of time where they assume that everybody is adopted. We have a cat named Leona, who actually happens to be from Britain. The girls call her Nana, which is her nickname. And at one point, I'll never forget Elise, our now almost seven-year-old, saying, "Mama, was Leona a baby cat in China?" Because she went through this wonderful period where she assumed that every child has to be adopted from China. And she has said that one day she's going to adopt a child, but she says, "I think China's too far to go. I think I'm going to go to Chicago." They have always grown up knowing about that. But, the fact is, as they grow older and smarter, some of their questions about adoption and their origins get a little sharper. And this is a tough story to tell kids. And I don't think you want it coming out all at once. They can understand when that they were adopted. But I think we get by on a lot of bromides now, which will have to be sharpened by information as they grow older. I don't think you can make a six-year-old or a three-year-old understand the kind of economic or political factors at work that provide for so many abandoned girls in China. And as they grow older, this is something that we're going to have to do our best to explain to them insofar as we can understand it ourselves.
What was it like for you and your wife when you were sitting in China waiting for your girl?
Well, the hard part of the wait comes the year, year and a half, 2 years you can spend waiting for your girl. Because at some point you get approved and then you wait. And that's when your mind can begin to play tricks on you. That's why, people coming up to you, meaning only to be nice, will say things like, "So what's new with your adoption?" You say, "Nothing, we've been approved, we're waiting." They'll go, "Well, that's been a long time. Anything going wrong there?" And the more you begin to think about it, something might have gone wrong. And you join these, which I do not recommend, by the way, listservs of people who are waiting. And it's kind of like GIs in combat. They have it all figured out. I think people on long adoption lists waiting have it all figured out. And you read these messages where someone says, "Oh, I talked to a buddy who knows someone here and there, and the number of adoptions is increasing, the number of adoptions is decreasing. They're going to cut them off entirely. They're going to open gates entirely." All that, 99% of which is nonsense, really does begin to play on your mind. And so that period is tough. When you finally get over there to adopt, the first time we had to go through several days of what we called adopto-tourism. They require that you stay several days in the country, they say it's to adjust your biological clock for time zones. I think clearly it's so that you drop a little money while you're there in addition to the adoption, because they, you know, they take you to the Great Wall and gift shop. They take you to the Silk Factory and gift shop. They take you to the, and of course you want to bring back something from that trip. Those are the hard days, because you know that, you're about to get your little girl and you can't like immediately fly there and pick her up. Second time was a little easier, perhaps because we'd been through it before. I met my family in Shanghai. They went over a couple of days before me because I had to do a show on Saturday. We got summoned with just 4 days' notice. And then the next day we had our second little girl, Lena, in our arms.
My guest is Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. He speaks in Sacramento on April 26th at California Lectures. He's also an author. His next book, to be published later this year, is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in Praise of Adoption. You're well known for tweeting, and one of your most recent tweets read, "It is gratifying to visit the storage locker that holds all your stuff your wife laughed at, and to have your daughter say, 'Cool.' What was it your daughters were looking at that your wife laughed at?"
Thank you for asking. Some of the stuff that I have brought back from my reporting assignments overseas, which tend to be things like wall hangings and rugs and the kind of thing a bachelor thinks will look real neat in his apartment. And then you get married and you have children. Your wife decides, oh, darling, I am sorry. This was. I said to her at one point, I brought home something, some piece of art from some foreign assignment after we were married and had children. And I brought it home under my arm and I said, "Darling, where can we put this?" And she said, "Darling, why don't you put it with all that wonderful artwork you brought home from Central America when you were covering the war in El Salvador?" And I said, "That's all on our storage locker now." And she said, "Oh, so it is." So we were down there the other day actually putting 100 copies of my novel Windy City in there. So that we will have them in perpetuity for our family. In any event, for our two little girls, it was like going to some kind of neat museum. They were, "Hey, Baba, what's this? Hey, Baba, what's that?" It was a great time.
I can imagine. Now, one of the most moving pieces you did on your show in recent years that I recall was when you got the CD of your father, Ernie Simon, who was a comedian, but he also worked on the radio. He worked on Chicago's WJJD, and this was in 1962. And you only alluded to this irony because you didn't want to beat it over the head, but we couldn't avoid it. Here was your father on the radio on Saturday mornings, and it was a very sad time for him.
Yeah.
Whereas for you, of course, Saturday mornings have been the defining part of your career. Why was it so tough for your father to be on the radio on Saturday mornings?
Well, in the best of all possible worlds, it wouldn't be tough for him to be on the air on Saturday mornings. But he, my father was a comedian. He was doing a show at that point, which involved no comedy. It was just, things like, "That was Patty Page, and now..." And it was a job that I think involved very little of his personality, very little of his creativity. And I think he had to inevitably reflect on the fact that, it was the downside of the active arc of his career, and also that he had literally squirted a lot of his career away with his drinking problem. And I think that although I love being there with him on Saturday mornings, I think this was just not the high point of his career by any stretch of the imagination. And that's why I'm very blunt about saying when people hear that, it's probably not going to bowl anyone over to hear his voice and know that just 6 years later he was dead.
Scott Simon, he's in Sacramento on April 26th at California Lectures. You are a baseball fan, a Chicago Cubs fan. I probably don't need to remind you the Cubs lost their first game of the season yesterday, 16-5. How do you feel about the season?
Well, I'm glad the season is here, and I like the new ownership of the Cubs very much, Tom Ricketts and his family, and I think they're exactly the kind of people who should be involved in baseball. And I'm glad they kept Lou Piniella on as the manager. I don't know. I don't want to be naive. I don't know as the Cubs have improved themselves so much they're going to be able to do brilliantly against the St. Louis Cardinals, which I think are the team to beat in the American League, not just their division. That being said, our six-year-old is a huge White Sox fan.
Oh.
And I am glad, because President Obama is a White Sox fan, because she feels a sense of identity with Chicago teams, and I think because she wants to be independent. Also, of course, they won a World Series just a few years ago, which is something that cannot be said of the Cubs. So did you see that magnificent play Mark Burley made yesterday?
Well, you called it in your Twitter feed the play of the season on opening day.
I have never seen a play like this, in part because it's so unexpected from a pitcher. I don't know, perhaps a lot of your audience has seen it now, but there was a hard smash back at him. It dribbled over by the first baseline, and he went over to retrieve it. Instead of just knocking it down with his glove and turning and throwing the ball, which would have been a perfectly respectable thing to do, it's what you're trained to do, after all. Somehow, from somewhere, he got the idea to throw the ball with his glove backwards between his legs. And it was a kind of an alley-oop toss that actually got to first base ahead of the runner, and the Sox first baseman caught it with his bare hand. I don't think anybody who saw it has ever seen a play anywhere like it. And, of course, it also came in service of just a great pitching appearance. I think Mark Burley is just one of the great underrated hurlers in baseball, if we can say that, as someone who has won a World Series, been to the All-Star game, thrown a no-hitter and a perfect game. Still, he often doesn't, you know, enter that ranking, that yes. mention of top pitchers, but boy, I think he's there. And you see a play like that, it reminds you of what you love about baseball. There is always something new to happen. We have never seen it all.
Indeed. Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, he speaks at California Lexus on April 26th. His upcoming book is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in praise of adoption. Scott Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the Nevada City woman behind hundreds of community meltdowns intended to help people lose weight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. When she was about to turn 60, Carol Carson decided she needed to lose weight, and she did. Carol lost 62 pounds. And in the process inspired hundreds of friends and neighbors in Nevada County to lose weight, too. It became famous as the Nevada County Meltdown. Hundreds of other communities followed suit. Carol Carson remains trim and active. She's also author of a weight loss book and coach for a national online weight loss program. This Saturday, the magazine American Profile is going to Nevada County to take a photograph of Carol and hundreds of friends. She joins us by phone. Carol Carson, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for inviting me to your program.
What was the specific thing that led you to decide you had to lose weight?
Well, it was pretty obvious. I stepped on the bathroom scale naked one morning. You know, I didn't want to put any underwear on and add a few ounces. and it broke.
Oh, really?
It literally broke. And I thought, well, maybe that was a sign. And I went out and bought a new scale. And darn it, those new scales are more accurate. I actually weighed more than I thought.
Well, that was your turning point for you. But many people who need to lose weight or could lose weight get on the scales, see that they're too heavy or heavier than they want to be, and think they should lose weight, but don't do it. What was different for you at that time?
The scale broke, and I really did treat it as a message from the, you know, it was time. But I think I knew that if I didn't make changes, I think I knew intuitively that I might not be around to be chatting with you here today. I had some medical problems. I mean, they were subtle, but my body was telling me, you know, you better take advantage of this opportunity before it's too late. And then I wrote about my experience of losing weight and getting fit, and then I offered to help people do what I had done in our community, and nobody was more surprised than I was when we had over 1,000 people show up.
You know, there's a joke about smoking that probably applies to weight loss, and that is giving up smoking or losing weight is easy. I've done it dozens of times. How do you keep it off?
Well, I think I decided I had three principles I followed, and I wasn't going to diet. First, I was going to make it fun. I was going to find fun ways to exercise that I just loved, so it was playful. And also, I was going to find food to eat that I enjoyed eating that wouldn't pack on pounds. So first, everything had to be fun. Second thing was that it had to be right for my body. At the time, I had a torn hamstring, so I had to be careful not to re-injure myself. So it had to be individualized to me. I wasn't going to eat according to anybody's diet plan or anything. I'd find out what worked for me. And then T, maybe the most important thing, because it was FIT for fit. fun, individualized, and tea together, I would team up with other people. And that was probably, if there was any genius in what I did, that's where it resided. Because by teaming up with other people, my gosh, we had so much fun, and we shifted the reality for a lot of people.
My guest is Carol Carson, author of From Fat to Fit, Turn Yourself into a Weapon of Mass Reduction. She's also national coach for the AARP Fat to Fit online community. And this Saturday, the magazine American Profile is taking a photograph of Carol and friends in Nevada County. The conventional wisdom is that as you get older, it's harder to keep weight off, and also perhaps even more so for women because of hormonal changes. Did that apply to you? Do you buy it?
Buy it. I mean, I excused myself for many years. I said I looked the way I did because everybody around me and my family looked the same way, but it was because we all ate too much. And I thought because I got older, that was why I didn't have energy. Silly me. Once I lost the weight, I had more as much energy as I had when I was in my 20s. And now, through stretching and yoga and the tennis and all the other exercise I do, I'm more flexible now than I was in high school. I think it's really easy to tell yourself those things, and especially if you look around and everybody around you is sort of looking the same way you do. But the truth is, our bodies are really resilient. They will respond to however we treat them, whatever our age.
You organized the original Nevada County Meltdown, and I read that over 1,000 people lost nearly 4 tons in 8 weeks.
That's right. And not only that, I mean, the thing took off. And not only that, but since then, over 300 communities have organized community weight loss events. And that's probably why American Profile, which is the fourth largest magazine in the U.S., and I think they have a print circulation of somewhere around 12 million, they're going to come back to us as one of the first pioneers in community weight loss and do a feature article. They're going to be here Saturday and taking a photo of all of the people that we can round up.
Is it for people who took part in the meltdown or not?
Well, we certainly want them to come, but we really want anyone who supports fitness. So we've invited bicyclists and elementary school kids who want to change. You know, a lot of our kids are overweight. We want to get them committed to eating more healthfully and getting a little more exercise. We've got high school students. We've got seniors that are busting in. We really want everybody because fitness is now everybody's business.
And where's the photograph going to be taken?
It's going to be taken under the Del Oro Theater on Mill Street in Grass Valley. There's only one main street in Grass Valley, so it's not hard to find. And incidentally, we'll take people from Sacramento, too. We're not proud. Or Roseville. We'll take people. We're not going to do any identity checks here. And we have a wonderful community walk plan complete with drummers and beach balls. And then, once again, spontaneously, what's arisen is a community health fair following the community walk with free flu shots and blood pressure tests and coloring books for kids or grandparents, all sorts of wonderful things at a health and fitness fair following the walk, following the group photo.
What have you learned since you lost all that weight when you were turning 60? What have you learned since then that you're applying now that you didn't know back then but has made a difference for you today?
I think the one thing that strikes me over and over is how important community is in achieving our weight loss goals. I mean, we really have to change sort of the landscape, the environment around us. When we did the Nevada County Meltdown, we created a kind of surround sound environment for residents here. If you went to the grocery store, you saw healthy menus. If you went grocery shopping, chances are if you tried to check out a box of Oreo cookies, the clerk would say, uh-uh-uh. If you went to a restaurant, there would be a meltdown menu. If you went to church, there would be something in your bulletin about the team you're on. So wherever people went, they were reminded about the importance of fitness. And I think that's the thing I learned. I have learned, and that's why I promote community fitness, is because it has to be done together as an entire community. It's just too hard to do alone.
Carol, what would you say to someone who came up to you and said, I really need to lose weight. I'm obese, but I can't do it just by exercise or restricting my food intake. I'm going to do stomach stapling.
You know, for some people, some kind of medical intervention is appropriate. One of the people in our AARP online Fat to Fit group a year ago couldn't walk, was wheelchair bound. She's had stomach stapling. She's had two knees replaced. She's lost 115 pounds. She's now exercising regularly at the Y. For her, it was a life-saving procedure. So I always go back to what's right for the individual. I didn't need to get my stomach stapled. I just needed to start moving and exercising differently. But different people will have different solutions depending upon their health, how much weight they have to lose, what their lifetime habits are. I mean, all of that has to be taken into account.
And are you where you would like to be weight-wise and fitness-wise?
Oh, I still have to pay attention to what I eat. I try and do the Japanese rule about eat until I'm 80% satisfied and then leave. If I know I eat at the table until I feel full, then I know I've eaten too much. So I try and eat till I'm about 80%. Really, I try and eat until I'm no longer hungry. And I try and really be careful to get protein in the morning and protein for lunch so that I don't get overly hungry at the end of the day. And now that I've taken on a role both at the national level and at the local level, I have to be careful that my work doesn't intrude on my exercise time.
Carol Carson, author of From Fat to Fit, Turn Yourself into a Weapon of Mass Reduction, national coach for the AARP Fat to Fit online community. This Saturday, the magazine American Profile is taking a photograph of Carol and friends in Grass Valley and the Main Street. Carol, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, and I hope some of your listeners join us on Saturday.
I have a hunch some will.
Bye-bye. Great.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Jamie Kroll and Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. The city of Sacramento is moving forward on a new arena plan. On the next Insight, we'll talk with developer Jerry Camillus about it. Also, a Holocaust survivor who was a cast member of an opera first performed in a Nazi concentration camp. She's coming to town. You'll meet Ella Stein Weisberger. Plus, we check in with columnist Marcus Bertone, and the Orangevale Grange celebrates 100 years. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.